Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
This is the New Books Network. We're joined today by Theodore Dalrymple. He is a retired physician in the United Kingdom, and he is the author of many books, including Life at the Bottom and Romancing Opiates. He is joining us today to discuss his latest book entitled False Positive, A Year of Error, Omission, and Political Correctness in the New England Journal of Medicine. Dr. Dalrymple, thanks so much for joining us on the New Books Network.
Thank you for asking me.
So please explain what this book is about. The subtitle gives us some sense that it's about the New England Journal of Medicine, but if you can set us up for what it is you were trying to do with this book.
Well, the New England Journal is one of the most important general medical journals in the world, if not the most important, and it's a weekly. And what I've done is taken some articles or an article from each week for 52 weeks and made a commentary on them. And the idea came to me because a nephew of mine, a French medical student, had to pass an exam in how to read a medical paper, which is a very good idea, actually. And he asked me for some rules, rough rules about how to go about it. And I looked more closely than I'd ever looked before at the New England Journal of Medicine, and I saw that it was full of error, and in its social commentary it was also pretty politically correct. And so I decided to do a kind of chronicle, taking, as I said, an article every week, maybe two articles, and criticizing them.
Okay, so this is a journal that is not going to normally be subscribed to or read by non-physicians, correct?
Yes, I don't think many non-doctors read it, no.
So, in other words, the readership is rather limited. It's limited to, and is it only published in English, or do we know if it's published in other languages?
I'm not sure about that. But okay. When you say it's a limited audience, it is limited, of course, to doctors. But there are a million doctors in America or something like that. And there are millions around the world. And it's read around the world, not only in the United States.
Okay. And so you were concerned with the PC element of it. But also you noted that there are errors. Now, when you talk about errors, what kind of errors are you thinking of?
Well, they can be very simple, such as that correlation is always taken as causation. And the problem with that is that sometimes the people who find this correlation have no hesitation in going from there to causation and from causation to public policy almost seamlessly. And there are many other kind of errors. They're slightly difficult to explain, but for example, if we take a screening procedure, often what you find is that when they look at the results, they look at the results of death from the disease which is screened for, and there's perhaps a reduction in the death from from that disease. But what one wants to know is whether there's an all-cause death rate reduction, because there's not much point in failing to die of one disease if you actually die of another. And this kind of thing is very, very common, actually. And then the other thing is another very common error, or omission, I suppose I would have to call it, is that a relative risk rate is given without giving an absolute risk rate, because you could have a very high relative risk rate while the absolute risk rate remains extremely low. And where you sometimes have to work it out for yourself what the absolute risk is. And where you have to do that, incidentally, is always very low.
And so I'm glad you mentioned correlation is not causation. This is one that obviously non-physicians of many stripes would be familiar with, because we can find correlations in everyday life or seeming correlations, and often mistakenly attribute causation to them. So the problem with this, it seems to me, is endemic to all aspects of trying to analyze the world. But in regard to medicine in particular, one thing that I've been cautioned about over the years is be careful about, for example, reporting on medical developments or articles that are published regarding medical studies, which is, you know, popular reporting in the popular media, because sometimes you get this very problem of popularizing something where causation is attributed to some degree of correlation. So is that one of your concerns when you're reading this? Is not that doctors necessarily will be misled, although that's possible, but also that the general public, once it learns of these studies, could be misled?
Yes, and there are examples of that. I remember some time ago, there was a correlation study between the level of selenium and heart attack, and it was found there was a correlation, and then everyone went off and bought Brazil nuts, because Brazil nuts are high in selenium, and for a time you couldn't buy Brazil nuts for love or money. And that's the kind of thing that is frequent. But it's not just the New England Journal, as you said. It's endemic. But for example, I read recently an article in JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association, which was trying to draw a causative relationship between death and drinking soft drinks. Now, I abominate the soft drinks. I think they're horrible, and I detest them. But what was being argued for in this article was public control of soft drinks, because there was a 1.08 increased chance of death, all-cause death, if you drank more than two such drinks a day for n number of years. And what was being proposed was a nationwide, if not worldwide, policy, on the basis of a correlation which could only be found, incidentally, after much statistical manipulation.
So that raises another question. I'm sure you're familiar with the publishing pressures that are on academics and research scientists to find something new and original. And it seems that reproducibility has been a significant problem in the scientific community. You may be familiar with I think it's called the Reproducibility Project in regard to psychological research.
Yes.
Where they've found rates of not much more than something like 30% of studies that they tried to replicate were in fact reproducible in terms of their results. And so what do you think about this as a problem within science and medicine in particular?
Well, it's a very big problem, especially where first of all, it's very difficult to reproduce, or people don't want to reproduce studies exactly. So they don't want to do exactly the same as what has been done before. So you're not quite sure whether if there's a different result, it's because their method is different. Secondly, there are kind of studies, enormous studies that are done, which are probably not reproducible at all, such as statistical examinations of 60 million people. Now, it's very unlikely that anyone is going to go and do another study of 60 million people.
So is this problem of things like reproducibility, correlation as causation, or the impression of it, is this a system-wide problem, or is it something that it can be pinpointed, for example, with the roles or the failure to embrace the full role of an editor, say, in a journal like this?
Well, I'm not quite sure about that. I mean, I would have thought that editors would hold up people who go too far in saying that correlation is causation. On the other hand, they want people to take notice of their journal and therefore to be too cautious means that no one will take any notice of you. So I suppose there are pressures on journals to be noticed. But this is again, I want to make it clear, this is not a problem unique to the New England Journal of Medicine, nor do I say that everything that appears in the New England Journal is bad. That would be a gross exaggeration. And in the book, I do mention articles which I think were of great merit and great interest. But this is a problem in all general medical journals, the British Medical Journal, the Lancet, and so on, all of them.
So let's talk about in detail one area of concern. So you're concerned with political correctness. So
yeah.
I think we all know what it means, but what does it mean to you? When you think of the phenomenon of it, this is something that's been around for 30 plus years now, perhaps, maybe even longer. How do you see it as a phenomenon, especially as it manifests itself among the experts within the field of medicine?
Well, the French have an expression, la pensée unique. It's the single view that can be taken by any decent person of a particular problem. And that view is promoted by a refusal to consider any other possible point of view. So one gets the impression that it's propaganda, and that to go against what is being propagandized means one is not merely mistaken, but actually a bad person. There are quite a few examples of that.
Okay, and so in the American context, I guess I would think of the tyranny of the majority problem, where you have a majority that becomes an absolute majority, it seemingly, and dissent is not allowed.
Well, you can have a tyranny of a minority as well.
Sure enough. Yes, true. And I guess that's probably what you're describing, perhaps, in the medical circles. So you, for example, one of the topics that you describe episodically by virtue of the arrangement of the book, because it's dealing with it's dealing with each week over the course of the year that you read these articles, is opioids. And yeah. So you've previously written a book on opiates. So can you explain how political correctness has affected medical practitioners' perception, or at least the way it's written about, regarding opioids?
Yes. Well, the National Institute on Drug Abuse defines addiction to heroin as a chronic relapsing brain disease. And it's just a disease like any other. It's like Parkinson's disease, not Parkinsonism. Parkinson's disease or rheumatoid arthritis or something like that. It's just something that happens to you. Now, this is a very reduced and, in my view, obviously false view of the problem. I don't claim to have the solution to the problem, but the idea that it is simply a disease like any other is false. And of course, once the idea that that it is a disease just like any other, gets into the culture, as it were, it's a reasonable expectation of people who are addicted that the doctor should cure him without really any effort on the patient's part, except to do whatever the doctor says, to take the drugs he prescribes or whatever it is that he does. And this seems to me not only false, but obviously false, or false on the most elementary consideration. So that, for example, if one takes an injecting heroin addict, how does he become an injecting heroin addict? I mean, is it something that happens to him, or is it actually something that he does, that he actually desires? Most injecting heroin addicts inject heroin on and off for about 18 months before they become physically addicted. So this is not, in my view, this is not a short time. Then the addict has to learn where to get the drug, how to prepare it. He has to learn how to overlook the side effects, and so on and so forth. And this obviously indicates to me that these people are actually aiming at addiction. It's a kind of romantic poet Modi kind of attitude towards heroin. It's not something that just happens to you. And yet this is the official medical view, although of course many doctors don't agree with it, but they almost don't dare say that they don't agree with it. And in the same way, we are now saying that obesity is just something that happens to you. It's got nothing to do with your behavior. It's just something that happens to you. It is a disease. Now, of course, there are medical consequences, both of addiction and obesity, and very severe ones. But that's not quite the same. There are medical consequences to almost everything that we do.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say one of the biggest causes of injury in the world, at least in the developed world, is sport. But I don't think anyone would say that sport is a disease. Some people might,
could be an addiction.
It could be an addiction, yes.
In regard to what might seem at first blush to be a rather common sense assessment of the volitional acts and steps that are needed, as you just explained, to become addicted, what then is your conclusion, or what do you think is the cause of this portrayal of addiction as essentially something devoid of, or at least that ignores or downplays the role of individual choice and responsibility? Is this a ideological project on the part of people who are editing and writing articles that regard addiction this way? Or is it merely kowtowing to what they see as a larger zeitgeist, knowing that their fellow physicians don't really believe that addiction is merely a happenstance condition? What do you think motivates this portrayal of addiction this way?
Well, I think this has been going on for a long time, and it's partly ideological, but it's also partly, I'm afraid, it all began in a rather sordid way, in that the NIDA went to Congress many years ago. I think it was early 1970s. I can't remember the exact date, and told them that addiction was an illness, and that there was a straightforward technical solution to it. And the reason they did that was because they thought that Congress would stump up money if they offered a technical solution just around the corner, but wouldn't if they said, well, there are a lot of social factors and psychological factors, and it's not straightforwardly a technical problem. And what we can see, I mean, the NIDA is incredibly self-congratulatory. It says we now know a lot more about it, and so on and so forth, while 300,000 people in America alone have died of overdoses of drugs that have either been prescribed or of addictions that started off with prescription drugs. And the complacency is astonishing.
Right. And so on the other hand, of course, we do have one finger that's being pointed in regard to opioids, at least in the American context, where you have pharmaceutical companies that are being sued by attorneys general at the state level, seeking some degree of compensation for the state and its costs, purportedly in relation to the problem of opioid addiction. Nevertheless, no lawsuits have been forthcoming against the medical doctors themselves who prescribed exactly. these opioids.
Yes. Well, you always sue the people with the most money.
Certainly enough. But doctors aren't coming up a pauper, though.
No,
you're quite right. You're quite right. I think, obviously, it's much easier to target large companies than it is individual physicians.
Yeah.
So in regard to the approach that's taken in portrayal of something like, you know, our working example here is the opioids problem. These are peer-reviewed journals, and that means there is, I assume, I don't know if the New England Journal of Medicine is what's called double-blind reviews. And just to explain, I'm sure most of our listeners understand this, but just to, so we're all on the same page, double-blind is where the author of a submission to a journal has that submission reviewed initially by the editors, and if they then think it is potentially worth publication, they'll send it out to usually multiple reviewers who do not know who the author is, and also the author will not know who the reviewers are, so it's blind on both sides, the so-called double-blind peer review problem or peer review process. But it may become a problem, and I guess what I'm building up to the question is, what if you dissent from this view? What if you write an article about the role of volitional acts in causing addiction? Is it essentially probably something that simply won't be published because it's dissenting from prevailing opinion?
Well, I don't know how many people have sent such articles in, but I would suspect that your chances of anything being published along those lines would be very slender. And you would be regarded, I think, as an unfeeling person for suggesting it. And I think the reverse is actually true. But certainly I haven't really seen anything in the New England Journal, for example, which has emphasized people's choices in anything, actually. And there are all kinds of omissions which are which one sees, which are obviously intended for emotional effect in the New England Journal.
So obviously a lot of the problems that are dealt with, medical problems or conditions that are being analyzed, studies that are being reviewed in the journals, not only New England Journal but other types of journals, they're going to have potential impacts on public policy. And so medicine's not simply medicine, obviously, especially in a system that you're accustomed to in England, the United Kingdom. It's, it is funded by the government in terms of what's treated. Access is often a matter of what can be, paid for. And so, what is your opinion then of how this, political correctness and method of review in the journals affects public policy?
Well, I think if you blind people to elementary truths, then I think you get bad policy. My objection is not, of course, to anybody's individual views. I don't mind in the least people expressing views which I don't hold myself. But I do find it difficult when actually what is being done is lying to the people responsible for making policies.
Okay, so are you thinking of particular lies, particular examples?
Well, I mean, for example, that addiction is an illness, and therefore okay. You create a huge bureaucracy to treat it as if it were an illness and then find actually the problem doesn't go away at all. On the contrary, it gets worse.
You had mentioned a problem earlier in passing or in answering an earlier question. We haven't discussed it yet, which is this notion of cherry picking data.
Yes.
And so you cherry pick something because you want to reach a particular result. That's unsettling from a layman's standpoint that experts who are publishing results would cherry pick data. Should we be unsettled or disquieted by this?
Well, yes. In some ways, things have got a bit better in that respect. So one particular form of cherry picking is the way in which data which are positive are emphasized, whereas data which are negative are not published. And this was a particular problem, for example, in studies of antidepressants, where trials which showed them to be effective were published, but trials which showed them not to be effective or to be ineffective were not published. Therefore, doctors were given a false impression of their efficacy, with the result that I think something like 16% of adults, not only in America but in the whole Western world, are now taking antidepressants. And of course, these drugs are not just harmless drugs. They do have, or can have, I should say, harmful side effects. Now, that problem has been at least partly addressed, and now when a trial is performed, the results have to be published, and that's an important advance. But there are other ways of cherry picking, and one can't prove that this goes on. But of course, if you take the problem of correlations, if you study enough variables, then some of them will appear to be correlated not by chance, but are actually correlated by chance. Because if you examine enough variables, you will get correlations. And one isn't always the correct way of going about things is to have a firm hypothesis in the first place. It's not just you don't send out a kind of fishing fleet to find correlations. Now, one is not always sure that this is what has been done. Another, I mentioned this case, a Danish study on on the effect of teaching a large part of the population cardiopulmonary resuscitation and putting defibrillators everywhere. It's easier to defibrillate someone than to post a letter now in Denmark. But anyway, they found that it had reduced the number of deaths from cardiac arrest outside hospital. But what was clear about this was that if you chose a different date to begin and a different date to end the study, you got a completely different result.
Mm.
So one couldn't be sure. In fact, I think it's highly likely that these people hadn't chosen the dates in order to justify the policy.
Right. So that's an obvious suspicion. It would seem to me that even from an expert standpoint like your own, that it would be often difficult to spot when correlation is good evidence of causation. In other words,
yeah.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, this problem in a way started when a very important correlation was found, namely that between smoking and dying of lung cancer. And the people who did that in Britain, and one man called Austin Bradford Hill, who was a statistician, not a doctor, actually laid down some ground rules not for proving that a correlation was causative, but for suggesting that it is. So that, for example, and I can't remember all of them, but for example, if there's a dose response curve, or if it's biologically plausible. And there are several other criteria. So you can look at those. But I actually, again, in these papers, it seems to me that nobody ever does look at these criteria, which are useful. They're not probative, but they're very useful. But they're not used.
So there's no obvious employment of at least a rather reliable, or at least a common sense, perhaps, reliability for a method that's already existing. If that's the case, if that's true, let me ask, this may sound like a stupid question, but what good then are these publications even for professional doctors? How helpful are they?
Well, I don't want to exaggerate because, of course, very good things are published in them. And the one example that I always give, because it startled me, was a discovery that peptic ulceration was largely caused by an infective organism, Helicobacter. And I remember reading this with almost disbelief. Well, not almost disbelief, with disbelief, I think it was about 1981 or 82 or something like this. And this was published in The Lancet, and nobody believed the two chaps who were Australians. No one believed it, but eventually it proved to be true. And these studies, which were extremely important because they have relieved an astonishing amount of suffering in the world, and I know this from my own experience because my father suffered for many years from peptic ulceration, and he had two dangerous operations, and his life was dominated almost by this illness. Well, it's virtually disappeared now. And these studies were published in The Lancet. And so it's not that they're no use, but they have to be read. All the studies have to be read very critically. I mean, and not many doctors have the time to do it. Most doctors I've asked, I mean, again, this isn't very scientific, but many of the doctors I've asked, I said, what do you do when you read the journal? And they read the summary and they read the conclusion and they presume that the conclusion actually follows from all that's gone before. But it's only when you read the papers line by line that you see the defects. For example, there was one study, and I can't remember which it was now, but the people who in the treatment arm, that is to say the people who were being given the new drug as against the old drug, well, several of them died, and then they were excluded from the final analysis of the results because they had died.
Which would seemingly be somewhat relevant.
Well, I think the average person would think it was relevant.
Sure.
The problem is that we don't have time for this very critical reading because it takes ages to read. Even one paper, really, it takes a lot. And the other thing is, of course, including me, you say I'm an expert. I'm not an expert at all. And, you know, the statistics are often so complicated that only a statistician could understand them. And probably many statisticians wouldn't agree with the statistical methods used in the paper. But even so, you can criticize the papers because, as I said, they always take correlation for causation.
Right. So I guess in some ways my question still stands. Not that you didn't answer it, but rather that I'm unsatisfied by the method that you've described, wherein it seems that you've been dealing with two problems, in other words, in this book. On the one hand, you're concerned with political correctness and the type of cultural atmosphere that does not readily allow for or entertain dissent. So that's one problem. And these could overlap and affect one another. But then there's the other problem, which sounds like, to sum it up somewhat clumsily, bad science or kind of clumsy science, or at least methodology that less than rigorous on the part of the people engaged in writing these studies or putting these studies together and then assessing them. And that latter problem, it seems to me, is not merely lamentable. It seems like it's also somewhat potentially dangerous, even for physicians, because as you say, it's a lot of time and effort to actually fully understand not only what a study is communicating or what value it might hold, but also what the potential problems are, because sometimes that's a puzzle piece that's not readily seen. And so I guess I don't feel much better about these journals after having read the book.
Well, I can't see a complete answer to this. I think a more rigorous editing might help, but it would make the journal quite a lot thinner.
Well, I'll tell you what it reminds me. When I was in college and I took a physical anthropology course, I was a history major, and it made me consider ever so briefly going into the hard sciences. And this remark that a professor made at the end of the course, she said, if you want to go into physical anthropology or any other science, you have to be comfortable with ambiguity and insufficiency of data and answers, which struck me as the exact opposite of what I had always conceived science in the broad sense was. In other words, if it was scientific, if it had that appellation, that meant it was certain. There wasn't doubt. It had been concluded, and it was in concrete, as it were. And instead, she gave me a completely different view, which is that science really is something that's always changing, it's evolving, and the answers by necessity must be tentative. And that's something that's stuck with me ever since. And your book reminds me of this, albeit in a disquieting way. So
yes, well I think she's right. I mean, I think you can exaggerate that. I don't think anybody is about to discover that actually the blood doesn't circulate in the body. Sure. So I think there are some things which are pretty well established. But it's true that, well, as we can see with, say, dietary advice, I mean, the less founded findings are in experimental biology, the more likely they are to be very, very, not doubtful, but provisional, shall we say. And you probably old enough to remember changes in dietary advice, so that
right, absolutely. Every year there's a new diagram,
it's not that there's absolutely no data to suggest that the new advice is correct. It's just that people exaggerate the firmness of the advice. And we can see, for example, how actually politics can interfere with advice, so that for a long time fat was regarded as evil. Well, actually, when I was very young, it was regarded as very good, and all healthy babies should be bathed in butter and that kind of thing. I'm probably older than you, and you should eat, 6 eggs a week or something, or maybe more. And then it became deadly poison. And now we discovered that the real poison is sugar. Actually, I do believe that sugar is pretty bad, and I have reason for thinking that. But it was very interesting how people who believed it was sugar 40 years ago were really prevented almost from putting their point of view, and I think have been shown to be more right than wrong. But anyway, most things are provisional, and after all, an improvement in technique lasts only as long as another yet greater improvement doesn't come along.
Well, another good point that you make about these journals, which we should all celebrate, is what you note to be one of the greatest, in some ways, as you put it, unsung advances in medicine over the course of, I guess, the 20th century primarily, is the use of or employment of controlled trials.
Yes.
and how these are essentially the bread and butter of these studies that are published in these journals.
Yes, except for the epidemiology, which often is not very well controlled. But yes, I mean, really, it's comparatively late in medical history that anyone has realized that personal experience is not sufficient to establish the worth of a treatment. I mean, you can say I've tried chicken dung for certain diseases and it's always worked. But if you don't know what doing nothing would have done, then you can't say it's worked. And this seems a pretty obvious thought. But actually, for most of medical history, most of human history, no one had it.
And so after this in-depth review of the New England Journal of Medicine, are you now more, have you changed the way you read this journal?
Well, all journals, really. It makes life, of course, much harder. It's much easier just to take a conclusion, store it in the back of your mind. I'm not practicing anymore, and actually I could only have done written this book after retirement, because I would never have had time for it before I was retired.
Right. The depth of investigation and review for each of these articles is substantial.
Yes, well, you have to read it with very close attention. And, of course, super specialists do read things with that kind of close attention. And I dare say more specialized journals don't suffer from this problem in quite the same way, from these problems in quite the same way.
Is that including the political correctness issue?
Yes, because they generally don't go in much for social commentary.
I see.
So okay. It's a general medical journals. But that is, after all, what most people, most doctors do read, if they read anything. And I don't see it. It's not an easily soluble problem. But I think we should be aware of it.
Absolutely.
And I think the general public should be aware, because if a newspaper says the New England Journal published this or the Lancet concluded that, they would think that it was coming down from Mount Sinai,
right?
Not hospital, but
sure. Yeah. And so, really, in that sense, this is, I think, every author wants the widest possible audience, but this was one that goes well beyond doctors in terms of how they read their journals and read the preface and the conclusion, and maybe they need to read it with a great grain of salt. But also for the general reader, it seems to me that there's a message here about taking these broad recommendations and conclusions from new studies for medical reporting, because presumably that's where these come from, is the next new issue of these journals, and that's where the studies are initially reviewed by reporters as well.
Yes. And I don't think, I suspect the reporters don't read them line by line either.
Well, that would be shocking. So,
mean if they did or if they don't?
Yes, I was being facetious. If they did, that would be quite shocking, in fact. But, well, thank you so much for discussing this. The book is False Positive, A Year of Error, Omission, and Political Correctness in the New England Journal of Medicine. And its author has joined us today, Theodore Dalrymple. Dr. Dalrymple, thank you so much for joining us on the New Books Network.
Thank you very much.